Okay. So good morning, everyone, and good to see you. And thank you, Kate, for explaining the situation here. We're toasty and warm in our Sangha members' basement here. And Kate, you may want to turn off your microphone because now I'm starting to get feedback. Great, thanks. Well, as some of you will remember, during the Loon Lake session, one of the talks I gave kind of focused on the teacher-student relationship in the Zen tradition. And in that talk, several times I mentioned the importance of trust. And just realized I don't know, completely trust BC Hydro anymore. Knocking off our power for the whole day. Anyway, here's a little piece of what I said during that talk. The teacher has walked on the trail before us. She's familiar with the terrain. It may not exactly be the same trail, but one similar, and that's usually good enough. But before walking very far, the student must address the question of trust. A strong measure of trust, not blind following, but of considered thoughtful trust, needs to be present to follow through on the discipline of Zen practice, and to fully consider the suggestions and comments of the teacher. Because after all, the teacher may point out things that we really don't want to see, or make suggestions that run counter to our own desires. So having trust in a teacher is to some extent essential if we are engaged in this hard work of transformation. And on the other hand, the teacher needs to work constantly to be trustworthy. But here's the strange thing. At some point, we come to see that the trust we have placed in the teacher becomes the trust in our own true being. So that's what I said. And in the talk, I spoke a little bit further about the necessity of trust and trustworthiness in the teacher-student relationship. And then afterwards, I thought it might be good to consider a little bit more about what we mean by trust, in the sense of relationship with another person, and in the sense of self-trust or innate trust in our own or in one's integrity. All of this from the point of view of Dharma. So what follows are some thoughts on trust and how it connects to our practice. And I hope these kind of comments will encourage all of us to consider what trust means, what trust means for each of us, what role trust plays in our lives. Some of us, maybe most of us, have had painful experiences around trust, particularly in relationships. Past disappointments have led us to live more perhaps in a place of distrust. Or at least we find ourselves with a strong hesitancy about trusting others, or maybe even trusting ourselves in some way. And then of course the opposite's true as well, right? Maybe you at times have experienced the pain of others not trusting you and being very clear about that. So for most people, and I certainly include myself in this, the tendency that we have, I think, is rather to avoid issues of trust because facing them can be so challenging and so unpleasant. So, mustering some courage, let's consider how we relate to trust and what trust may mean in terms of our practice. So one thing I did is I went to the Cambridge Dictionary. And the Cambridge Dictionary defines trust like this: a belief that someone is good and honest and will not harm you, or that something is safe and reliable. That's interesting. And then I looked up the etymology of trust. And the word trust comes from Old Norse, the Old Norse language. And the word in Norse is traust, T-R-A-U-S-T. And the original meaning of traust meant protection or support. And apparently it's also the root of the word true in English. So when we trust others, I think we rely on them to be competent, to be willing to do what we wish them to do or what they said they would do. And going a bit further, we may also say we rely on them to be more or less as we see them to be, or as they present themselves to be. And as the dictionary definition goes, we believe them to be good and honest, not wishing us harm. These are some of the expectations or views that we hold, for example, when we visit a medical person for a consultation or a procedure. We have to have some level of trust in the way I've just described it. But the dictionary definition does not mention that in trust we become vulnerable to others. In trust we become susceptible to betrayal. So trust is deeply important, highly important, but it's also dangerous. Without trust of others, we would deny ourselves all kinds of, well, we deny ourselves opportunity for deep friendships, for love, for advice, for help. Without trust, how could we even think about going to a doctor or a dentist or even call a plumber or take the car to have the brakes looked at? Or give our time, give our attention to a teacher? But trust also involves the risk that the people we trust will in some way fail us. Trust involves uncertainty, along with some measure of assurance that we can rely on this person or this group. So, as I said, earlier, trust is a necessary foundation for the teacher-student relationship. But of course, both student and teacher are human. And being human, the chance for mistakes and misunderstandings is always there, as is the possibility of betrayal, a kind of deliberate hurting, perhaps out of anger or some other reason. So trust is therefore risky. And what we risk while trusting is the loss of what we have entrusted to others. So I would say betrayal of our trust damages our expectations of those we have trusted. It alters our view of their integrity. And if we're deeply shattered by the betrayal of our trust, we may even lose trust in ourselves, or lose our own self-respect, our own sense of confidence. So, personal trust between individuals, I think, really expresses a kind of mutual respect and connection. In Sangha, the shared commitment to live a life that embodies the precepts, that holds the intention to apply the Buddhist teachings and to examine one's own life, that creates a container for mutual respect and connection, or at least the possibility for mutual respect and connection. So in this way, I think Sangha and our commitment to Sangha opens the possibility for mutual trust to grow and to strengthen. So I was thinking about this, what makes personal trust in the context of Sangha perhaps different from, say, the workplace or school? And I think it's when when trust builds, mutual trust builds within the Sangha context, it develops or becomes more of a spiritual practice, one that helps us mature our character through our intention, our shared vows, our shared discipline, as we practice in community together with other people. So trust in others and being trustworthy ourselves. In this way, we contribute to a harmonious sangha, a harmonious community. And over time, I think we open to the possibility of making spiritual friendships, or as it's called in the Pali language, a Kalyana Mitra. That's the language of the early Buddhist texts, as I'm sure most of you know. So Kalyana Mitra, this spiritual friendship as it's often translated in English, literally means good friend, or another translation I found was a friend of true worth. Clearly, when we read the early texts, the Buddha placed high value on Kalyana Mitra and a high value on trust. In the Dhammapada, a collection of sayings spoken by the Buddha in verse form and one of the earliest and most widely read of all the early Buddhist texts, the Buddha said this. He said, "A trusted friend is the best relative." A trusted friend is the best relative. Isn't that lovely? In another text, the Buddha said, "One who is worth of your trust and who trusts you in return, who listens to you and who is patient with you, accompany them in your life." Let me just read that again. One who is worth of your trust and who trusts you, who listens to you and who is patient with you, accompany them in your life. Good advice, I think. When I read these early Buddhist texts, I'm deeply moved by the Buddha's skill in building a sangha, a community based on friends of true worth, of trust. He brought together wealthy merchants, common soldiers, farmers, prostitutes, mothers distraught at the loss of a child, mendicants, wandering monks, murderers, the desperately poor, those lusting for power, members of all the castes that were present at that time. He brought them all together, and they lived in Sangha. The Buddha, having lived as both a solitary monk and a wandering mendicant, and with groups of other monks, he deeply knew the value of a shared life in the Dharma. He knew the value of Kalyana Mitra based in trust. Now, the Buddha also knew about the betrayal of that trust. And one example of this is Devadatta, who was a monk at the time of the Buddha, part of the Buddha Sangha, and he was also a cousin of the Buddha. And according to the early texts, when the Buddha was elderly, Devadatta proposed formally at a meeting of the Sangha that the Buddha should retire and hand over the leadership of the Sangha to him. Well, the request was refused. And later, Devadatta created a schism within the Sangha, claiming that the Buddha's discipline was not strict enough. Monks needed stronger discipline. And even later, according to some stories, Devadatta tried to kill the Buddha. And I just found this out recently. Towards the end of Devadatta's life, he realized the harm that he had done. And he set off to apologize and make amends. But unfortunately, he died before he reached where the Buddha was staying. Trust. Well, the Buddha was no stranger to distrust either, or betrayal of trust. So in Pali, the word trust is, or how the word that's often translated for trust from the Pali is the word sadda. And sadda literally means to place one's heart upon, to place one's heart upon. So to have trust, at least from this point of view, is to offer one's heart or to give one's heart, right, that most intimate part of yourself. And to receive the trust of another, therefore, is to receive that heart of the other person. And therefore, so precious. It is a deep act of intimacy and connection. And so, trust demands our deep care and our deep attentiveness. But, of course, being conditioned human beings, we often fumble and inadvertently damage or through our conditioning perhaps injure the trust that is given to us. This is one reason in our Soto Zen tradition that we have the full moon ceremony every month. And that's a time for each of us to reflect on our conduct and to renew our commitment, of course, to living a life in accord with our understanding of the precepts, our understanding of our vows. In earlier times, this was done twice a month by the monks and nuns, so they could bring forward ways that they perhaps had broken trust with others, broken trust with themselves in some way, and reaffirm the intention to repair and to maintain trust and the precepts. So Sangha, I think, really offers an opportunity for interpersonal trust. But like all human relationships, we need to exercise due care and carefully enter into relationships of trust and be aware of our own tendency, perhaps, to in some way damage the trust that is given to us and the trust that we have of ourselves. Because it's not unusual to confuse trust with our own desires and expectations. When we, air quotes, kind of trust a person to meet my needs, to not change or to change and be how I want them to be, these are kind of examples of trust based on demands or desires. And as we all know, that kind of, again, I'll call it counterfeit trust, leads to really painful conclusions. We can be manipulated by the demands of counterfeit trust, and we can manipulate through a false understanding of trust, demanding that others meet our expectations of what we consider to be trustworthiness. So trust and trustworthiness, in this case, when it's manipulated, can become, well, they become weapons. Or they can perhaps be part of a self-fulfilling prophecy that I can't trust anyone, or I certainly can't trust that person anymore. That person's completely untrustworthy. When in fact, there was never really true trust there in the first place. We just wanted them to act and be the way we thought they should be. Anyway, I realize none of this is really easy to sort out. But our practice requires us to look closely at our own patterns. And as Dogen says repeatedly throughout all his writings, examine this thoroughly. And I believe that this examination is the first step to any kind of repair when trust is broken. Everyone comes to the Zendo, to the place of practice, I think with plenty of human needs. They come. Some people will bring trust. Others will bring mistrust. Of course, people bring expectations, their unrecognized conditioning, their wounds, all kinds of things we bring to the Zendo. And as one of the guiding teachers, I know that I disappoint a number of those who come to the Martin Rain Zen community. And personally, that's quite painful. But I also see that this disappointment is simply part of the human condition. That despite good intentions and efforts, that misunderstanding and confusion will always arise. And that a trusting relationship may not form. And of course, need I mention that this can happen between two Sangha members or two people? It just happens. But when trust is broken, in some minor or major way, we work to repair the trust. We try to speak clearly, we try to speak compassionately, and we forgive when possible. And this is not easy. But I think it's possible. Or perhaps I should say made more possible. Because there is a trust that grows naturally within us just from our efforts at practice, the whole process of our practice. That practice leads us to trust the kind of glowing ember of goodness within each person, including ourselves. And when we're aware of that kind of, I'm calling it a glowing ember or a little spark of goodness, when we become aware of that, that truly is within everyone, I think that makes the work of building trust and of repairing trust more possible. Linji Yixuan, one of the great Chinese Zen teachers in the 1800s of the Tang Dynasty in China, said this: if your trust is insufficient, you will keep on wandering in confusion. No matter what the circumstances, you will be controlled and led by others. You will not find freedom because you don't have enough confidence, enough trust in yourselves. You search outwardly. Now, Linji, the great, he's also called Rinzai in Japanese, maybe that's a name you're more familiar with. But anyway, Linji was not talking about the kind of trust or confidence that, you know, you kind of can get in a very expensive weekend workshop, you know, the kind of, you know, rah, 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 me kind of workshop. He was encouraging his students to trust their own basic goodness, their own Buddha nature. Linji places value on cultivating a trust that's based on searching within, a trust that does not rely on others, on Buddhist texts, on the teachings of teachers, or on commonly accepted views. It is trust that comes from within. And this is echoed in other Buddhist texts as well. In the Diamond Sutra, one of the key texts of the Mahayana stream of Buddhism, the Buddha says this: fearless bodhisattvas do not cling to a dharma, much less to no dharma. This is the meaning behind the Tathagata saying, a dharma teaching is like a raft. Don't cling to anything. This image of a raft appears in various places in the Buddhist texts, and it's used to illustrate the view that the teachings are not holy in and of themselves. They're simply a skillful means, a map to help us. Don't trust them. Don't place your complete trust on them. So where do we find a trust that does not rely on the Buddhist texts or on the teachings of teacher, the words of the teachers, or on commonly accepted views? Well, Dogen Zenji, the Japanese monk who first brought this form of practice from China to Japan in the 1200s, he wrote this: "Those who practice the Buddha way should first of all trust in the Buddha way. Those who trust in the Buddha way should trust that they are, in essence, within the Buddha way. Where there is no delusion, no false thinking, no confusion, no increase or decrease, and no mistake. Arousing such trust and illuminating the way in this manner and practicing accordingly are fundamental in studying the way." That's a little bit of a long quote. The first sentence, first part of it, I think, is really key. Those who practice in the Buddha way should first of all trust in the Buddha way. Those who trust in the Buddha way should trust that they are, in essence, within the Buddha way. So Dogen brings forward a little further the Buddhist view of trust, a little bit further than Linji describes it. Dogen tells us in his kind of poetic way that we can trust our life, that our life is in essence the Buddha way. Our life, in its essence, is free of false thinking, confusion, and mistake. Whoa. Let me read you one more passage. Let's see if we can, about this, see if it makes it a little clearer. He writes this. This is a different place, but again, Dogen's words. "Know that the root of trust is not self, not others. It is not forced by the self, nor is it created by the self or led by others, because it is not established by the self. It has been intimately entrusted through East and West, the entire body embodying trust is called trust. The entire body embodying trust is called trust." What Dogen is telling us is that there is a trust that goes far beyond trust in others or trust in one's own ability and knowledge. And I think we may call this a trust in our true being or a trust in our Buddha nature. And so how does one cultivate or maybe become aware of such trust? In our Soto Zen tradition, we cultivate this trust primarily, I think, through our practice of Zazen, of sitting meditation. Although we first come to the Zendo, to the meditation hall, with ambitions to become perhaps a better person, maybe an awakened person, after a while, when those kind of fires of ambition and striving begin to die down a little bit, we become more aware of a fundamental, calm goodness that is simply present there. Now, perhaps those words aren't quite good, aren't quite correct. But let me kind of continue using them for a moment. With some awareness of this kind of fundamental goodness, trust in practice, and trust in oneself, trust with oneself, blossoms. It strengthens. We become more deeply aware of it. And this trust is not based on someone else or a teaching or in anything else external. It is a facing inward, and in that way meeting the trust that has always been present. Our Zazen practice is a practice of trust. Sitting quietly, not striving to manipulate our life, we settle into our life as it is, without attempting to fix, to do, or change. And in Zazen, aspects of our life will be illuminated sometimes. Sometimes insights will arise. Sometimes. But so does the trust. I was trying to think of a verb to use, because I think that trust is simply there. Like we've been working our way through a thick forest, and we suddenly come to a deep, calm pool that has always been there. So that trust that we become aware of, that we have so long been looking for, that calmness, that goodness, we realize to some extent has always been present. And with that trust in Zazen, with the trust of our fundamental goodness, we open to trust in the cedar trees, to trust in the clouds, to trust in the falling snow, to birds at the feeder. Trust that we are not separate, that we are not cut off from this world. In and through this practice, we open to the trust of this moment. This moment, exactly as it is. Well, at the beginning of this talk, I quoted a paragraph from a talk that I gave at the Loon Lake Session. Just a few weeks ago. And I ended that by that part that I read by saying this. But here's the strange thing. At some point, we come to see that the trust we have placed in a teacher becomes trust in our own true being. I believe this to be true. And one of the reasons it's true is that there is no difference. Ultimately, there is no difference in trust. Trust of the teacher leads us, along with all the other ways that we trust, ultimately to trust in ourselves, lead us deeper to trust in this moment, trust of the world. Another way of saying, we are not separate. We are not cut off. So please take all this with a grain of salt, but please also, over this next little while, examine your own sense of trust. Where does it come from? Where does it go? What does it feel like? to give your trust deeply to another person? What does it feel like to receive the trust of another? Okay, thank you all for listening, and I guess I'll stop here.